Heiser. I've been here at Gettysburg for 19 and a half long years of working in the Interpretation and Maintenance Division. I know a little bit about the field, and they asked me to come and talk to you this afternoon and give you a quick tour of the slider farm area, and tell you a little bit about the importance of it, why the farm is important, and why what happened here as far as the battle is concerned. Number one, really appreciate everything you've done by coming and working today on your day off and taking your free time to help us out at the park, because without volunteers like you guys coming here to do this, the park would be in pretty bad shape. It's the same for the adopt position people and the volunteers we have working behind the desk, the volunteers who go out and give walks in the cemetery. The Park Service cannot survive, especially Gettysburg can't survive, without a little help from the public. And plus, you guys are the ones who own this park. So it's really helpful for us, and we really appreciate you taking care of it. The John and Catherine Slider Farm. This little farm stuck out here in the middle of nowhere is kind of an anomaly in itself. It's interesting in that it's off the beaten track. Very few people even know it's here. It's one of the probably strangest little farms we have here at Gettysburg, because it's very much like it was in 1863. John and Catherine Slider actually did not... were not born and raised in Adams County. They were both born and raised in Maryland. They moved here in the 1850s, and John Slider, at the time, was in his mid-40s. He purchased the property here, just about roughly 80-some acres of land. At the time, there was nothing here. The first thing he built was the barn. Now, the barn we initially built was not in that configuration. It was a single-bay log barn. By single bay, I mean just a square log barn with a roof. Why did he build the barn first? Protect his farm animals. At the time, he probably had a cow, maybe two horses, and a wagon, and that was about it. He built that first, built a temporary shelter for the first winter here, and then in 1857, he constructed this stone house. This is all local field stone. Stone has been mined from this area here, brought in and built in this configuration. Stone was a easily accessible construction material in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s. Witness the Bushman farm just up the road here, and also the Rose house and the Rose barn and what's left of it. Granite was easy to get down in this area. In the 1970s, the Park Service had a living history farm here that called it the Granite Farm. The Sliders never called it the Granite Farm. That's a Park Service name that was stuck onto it for a living history site. But the house was built in 1857. John and Catherine moved in with their five children, settled in, and then he expanded the farm. Cleared about 48 acres and turned it into pasture. He also had a large garden somewhere on the other side of the house here. We're not exactly sure where. He also planted an orchard across the lane, which today is all woodland. And all this area down here was naturally open. He expanded the farm with a couple of other small outbuildings, including the woodshed and the summer kitchen. The summer kitchen, the two-story house that the gentleman's painting right now, actually the lower part of that is very early. He added, or somebody after the war, added the second story to it and added the nice siding so it looks nice and new. But actually the early part of the summer kitchen is the first floor. Then he added the woodshed to the side. So these are all Civil War structures. The hog pen and chicken house here are post-battle structures. Both of those were probably built initially in the 1880s or 1890s by the subsequent owners of the field. The Park Service, actually, excuse me, the War Department, purchased this farm in 1895. At the time, the structures that were here now, are here now, were here then, except for the little smokehouse behind you. That is a 1974 structure. The blacksmith shop you see back in the background, the log building, that is not native to this farm either. That was, I believe, came from Blue Ridge Summit or Blue Ridge Gap, was donated to the park and moved here en masse in 1974 and constructed there when this was part of the living history farm. But in 1863, John and Catherine Slider were really just eking out a living here for they and their five children. The oldest one married a lady named Rogers, who at the time of the battle is famous for having been in her home up on the Emmitsburg Road baking bread for the soldiers on July 2nd as they were under fire. But he was the only one who had moved out. John and Catherine were here with their four children. with the approach of the armies on July 1st and then on July 2nd, John Catherine decided to take their families, whatever food and provisions they could take with them, and they went to see relations, eventually wound up down near Taneytown, Maryland. The farm literally was abandoned to whoever had possession of it on the second day of the fighting. Now, as you well know, the fighting on the second day doesn't really start north, east, or west. It starts right here. The 2nd United States Sharpshooter is sent out from Birney's division of the 3rd Army Corps. They deploy in this area and deploy along the fence lines and the ridge, flight ridge just to the west of it here, adjoining the Bushman Farm. Got to take you back 100 and some years. This area was much more open at the time of the battle. Those trees over there did not exist. The entire area was open. You could see the Bushman house and the barn up there, which is barely 500 yards in that direction. Just to the north is Devil's Den. Devil's Den is maybe about 500 yards through the trees here. This is all open ground. It had been cleared for pasture. Big Round Top was visible. You could see right here. Anything on Big Round Top could see you. Same for Little Round Top. This area really was the only was open, wide open. So anybody moving through here could easily be fired upon by the Union batteries in Devil's Den or anybody up on Little Round Top and Big Round Top. Be that as it may, the Union soldiers really did not know that the main Confederate assault was going to take place in this area on the afternoon of July 2nd. The 2nd U.S. sharpshooters had been sent out in this area because they had seen a Confederate battery deploy up on the southern extension of Seminary Ridge just beyond the Bushman Farm. The 2nd U.S. was sent out here just to skirmish and shoot up the cannoneers and really just guard the left flank. Little did they know that the main Confederate assault was going to start from that direction and sweep right through here. Two brigades. The 1st Brigade was Law's Alabama Brigade. They swept down the ridge, Seminary Ridge, through the farm here, and then actually split as they went around the farm buildings. Three regiments went to the right, the 15th Alabama, which we all know fought who? 20th Maine, the guys who saved the Union, some. The 15th Alabama actually kept shifting to the right, not because they were being fired upon, but because the 2nd U.S. actually fell back onto Big Round Top. There was at least one company that went up Big Round Top, and Oates evidently kept shifting his men so they could keep the skirmishers fronting these sharpshooters as they swept them into the woods here. He changed the direction, swept over Big Round Top, and then finally got into the Little Round Top and Devil's Den area fight. Robertson's brigade, the 1st Texas, also passed through here. Their right flank passed just on the north of the buildings here as they swept down into the bottom here towards Devil's Den. And then Benning's Georgia Brigade also passed through this area before they struck the Devil's Den area. More or less the fighting passed over here on July 2nd. It was very brief, but what happened here was this became a hospital site. The Confederates who were wounded at Devil's Den, Little Round Top fighting, and on Big Round Top retreated to this area because this was the first group of farm buildings. Reportedly, the surgeon of the 48th Alabama arrived here at the farm buildings late on the afternoon of the 2nd. He established a temporary field hospital here before he was ordered to take the hospital out here. They were under fire from the artillery and the infantry on Devil's Den and Little Round Top. He moved the field hospital out of here, but not before the house and the barn and everything here was ransacked. In the claim that the Sliders filed in 1876, actually the heirs, John Slider filed, they claimed that at least 50 yards of carpet had been taken and used. The Confederates cut it up and used it for blankets, or it was ruined because it was saturated with blood. There were so many wounded that were in the house, the barn, and the outbuildings here before they were taken back to a field hospital. They also lost about $200 worth of implements, all the saddles that they had here, the horse harnesses. They lost all the food that they had been saving up for the winter, and about 250 pounds of ham and smoked meats were also taken. Literally everything was ransacked. All their food and supplies and personal effects were gone. They filed a claim for $780-some, of which they received
nothing.
Nothing, that's right. Because the Confederates took it. The Union didn't take it. So that's the way the War Department looked at it. the sliders, if anybody lost anything, they did. September of 63, about 2 months after the battle was over, they put the farm up for sale. They tried to sell it. There were no takers. They tried again the following year. And finally, in 1869, they sold the farm and moved to Ohio, where John Slider died in 1872. And the Slider family, or the descendants of the Slider family, still live in Ohio today. Most of the fighting swept through here on the afternoon of the 2nd, but what happens here on the afternoon of the 3rd really is probably one of the most tragic stories of the Battle of Gettysburg, and there are a number here. Late in the afternoon of the 3rd, there's really no one in this area except for the 1st Texas, part of the 9th Georgia, part of the 4th Alabama, and part of the 48th Alabama. They're really stationed in this area just guarding the Confederate right flank. Late in the afternoon, about 3:30, 4 o'clock after 6, the assault has been thrown back. Judson Kilpatrick, who was the division commander for the Union cavalry in this area, he gets orders from an aide who arrives and says that Hood's division is pushing the Union left. He needs to make a demonstration in this area just to stop Hood, just to stop these Confederates from making a demonstration of turning the Union left. Now, who this aide was and exactly who sent him down here, where he came from, nobody really knows. But evidently, he was attached to Pleasanton's staff. General Alfred Pleasanton, as you know, was the Union Cavalry Corps cavalry commander during the Battle of Gettysburg. Kilpatrick took this order and sent it down to his first brigade commander, who at the time was Elon J. Farnsworth. Farnsworth was brand new, just had been promoted to be a brigadier general of volunteers about 5 days before the battle, and this was his first and regrettably last battle that he was in. There was a confrontation between Kilpatrick and Farnsworth as to what was to be done here. Kilpatrick ordered a charge into the Confederate rear, and the charge turned out to be a complete disaster and a complete failure, resulting in the regrettable death of Elon J. Farnsworth up here on the slope of Big Round Top. That's where we're going to go next. We're going to take a path up to the First Vermont Monument. From there, we're going to go out to South Confederate Avenue, wind up on the Bushman Farm Trail coming back in, and we'll wind up right back here. It's going to take probably about 45 minutes to walk it. I hope everyone feels like walking. I'll try and take it easy, but we're out on the road. Really be careful because of the traffic. People are not looking at you. They're looking at the trees and the bugs and the birds and everything else. And if you get in their way, they're going to run right over you. So please be careful.
All right, we're leaving the front yard of the Slider Farm and going down the path.
View of Long Street, which is on the ridge. Hood rode down towards the Bushman Farm. There's a small orchard on the north, or the, excuse me, the southwest side. I think it was near that orchard that he was wounded.
That says he was wounded in a lane between two stone fences. I think
there's part of the Bushman
and
lane.
There is, I know, I've seen on the map right around by that orchard, there is one of those over there.
Right.
But the thought was, well, it was over here by the Slider where there was two stone fences, but you're saying that's where you think it was. And that makes more sense, it being in direct line of the artillery at Peach Orchard. And
right. Because Longstreet had had the confrontation with meeting with Hood, and then he rides on, and no more than like 5 minutes later, an aide rides up and says, General Hood's been wounded. So Hood didn't have enough time to get all the way down here.
Yeah, I wasn't aware that conference and that aide that had taken place.
Yeah. It's all open. It's all clear.
There, the Wells Relief, the identification of all those guys.
Yeah.
It's amazing to go and then look at all that, and you can almost make them, you know, make them out, their faces. And
I never realized that they could identify everybody on that plaque until Scottsville about a year ago. I had no idea.
I've got it in the right here, the relief from the dedication ceremony.
I know we're talking about something about him, but we know that the relief, he's got the key to the, all, that's it, you know, all the guys.
It's amazing just to stand there and look at all of it. I mean, the whole thing is laid out right there.
It really makes it so much more personable when you know who was who on the relief.
The count in battles and leaders, the coincide with it.
Yeah.
That was all clear all the way back to here?
You could stay where they have a cut, you could see this.
Sure, you could stand right here and see Devil's Den.
I walked this way and then over, but, man, that's a lot.
The only thing we're here, we're actually,
we're standing in front of the first Vermont Calvary Monument.
There were some sparse trees here, but from that wall down, you can see right to the Slaughter Farm.
Put that big monster tree in the sky. Is that here then?
Nah. No, I don't know about that one. There's a real...
That's a big shot.
It's probably pre-battle. It's definitely probably pre-war.
Is there a way to tell without chopping the tree down how old it is?
The guy from the State Forestry Unit said he could look at it and test the bark with like an acid treatment or something and actually tell the age of it. And I know we have at least 10 trees in the park that are pre-battle. There's one at Devil's Den, Seminary Ridge, I know of, Walnut Tree up on North Hancock, there's two over in Culp's Hill,
Sickles Tree.
One up near Cemetery Hill,
Sickles Tree, at the headquarters tree across from the Toronto House, is that?
Maybe, I don't know about that. This is, we just followed a wood path, a wood trail. And in 1863, that wood trail existed. This was the trail that Slaughter used to get to this area. This was his upper pasture. This entire area was open. It was bordered by a stone wall you see right there. That's the original stone wall, topped with rail fences. Now, on this side, about probably maybe 50 feet or so through the woods, there's the remains of a stone wall that at the time of the battle was topped by rail fences. The Confederates in this area were facing Union troops up on Big Round Top, which included the 20th Maine, Pennsylvania Reserves, and a few other units. When Farnsworth made his attack, he came off a slope just south of the Bushman Farm. The 3rd Battalion of the 1st Vermont Cavalry, led by, at the time, Major William Wells, came down into the valley, into the Slaughter Farm area. They were fired on by Confederates and a Confederate battery up on Seminary Ridge. Wells turned to the right. Farnsworth was at the head of the 1st Battalion of the 1st Vermont Cavalry. He follows the 3rd, so together the two come through this area, through the Slaughter Farm, and all along the way, one of the officers is shouting, it's an ambuscade, which means it's an ambush, we've been ambushed. There are Confederate sharpshooters still up in Devil's Den. One regiment, part of the 15th Georgia, comes flying down from their wood cover up in the Triangular Field area of Devil's Den. They start to fire on the 1st Vermont as they come through this path, and they follow this trail right to where we are now. Now, exactly why they followed this path, no one really knows today. After the battle, the veterans themselves, no one really wrote why they came up here. But at the time, the point they got up here, evidently, they thought they could sweep around and get back to their lines, which were maybe about 300 yards just south of here. They got to this point, got up here, and right ahead, that wall was just lined with Confederate troops, the 4th Alabama, part of the 48th Alabama, and part of the 44th Alabama. There was a huge volley that emptied saddles. Farnsworth himself, Elon J. Farnsworth, had been shot from the saddle. His horse had been shot down near the Slaughter Farm buildings. Another trooper dismounted, gave Farnsworth his horse. Farnsworth mounted the horse and followed his troops up here. Farnsworth was not the first one up here. Somewhere along the way, he evidently was either struck by a mini ball or struck, wounded somehow, because when he got up to this point, he was wounded and somebody noticed blood on his uniform. Let me tell you a little bit about Farnsworth. Elon J. Farnsworth was born in Michigan. He was a very young fellow. He had no real military experience. He had entered the University of Michigan and then was discharged along with a couple of other students because of some sort of unnamed incident. And evidently it involved hazing of fellow freshmen or whatever happened, but Farnsworth left the University of Michigan and then went west. He was out in Utah for a while. He did a lot of just adventurous things. And when the war broke out in 1861, he enlisted as a private in the 8th Illinois Cavalry. Now, the 8th Illinois was led by his father. Farnsworth rose through the ranks. He started as a captain, became the adjutant of the regiment, and no one really knows how, but he wound up on Pleasanton's staff. He was a favorite of Pleasanton's. Alfred Pleasanton thought Farnsworth was really a great officer, very efficient. And on June 28th, he recommended that Farnsworth be promoted to Brigadier General Volunteers and be given a brigade, which he was. That same date that Custer also received a promotion to Brigadier General Volunteers and took over the 1st Michigan Cavalry Brigade in Kilpatrick's division. But Farnsworth is brand new to command. The first thing he does is he gets to know all the officers of his regiment, the 1st West Virginia, 5th New York, part of the 18th Pennsylvania Cavalry, and especially the 1st Vermont. The 1st Vermont is a very good cavalry regiment. They have not had good experiences. They're in the Shenandoah Valley under Banks in 1862. They really got their clocks cleaned down there. They lost half of their men just to capture because men weren't taking care of the horses. The horses broke down, the men were abandoned, and wound up being picked up by Stuart and his cavalry in the 1862 Valley Campaign. 1st Vermont did not have a very good record prior to the Battle of Gettysburg. They had dressed up a little bit because they'd gotten rid of the officers who were not that good. Guys like William Wells, who came along, who really was a very strict disciplinarian, very good officer. By the time of Gettysburg, the 1st Vermont actually was a very good regiment. They'd suffered a lot of losses during the campaign just because the horses had broken down. They lost almost 200 men in the campaign from Northern Virginia to Gettysburg, including Brandy Station, just by horses breaking down and not having the availability of horses to remount these men. There were at least 100 of them down in Frederick, Maryland, waiting for mounts to come while the regiment was up here fighting. And everyone always talks about the Confederate horsemen. The Confederate horsemen, if they lost their horses, they were out of luck. In some cases, it was very much the same for the Union side. But be that as it may, the 1st Vermont had been skirmishing throughout the morning of the 3rd, and here they are in this mounted cavalry charge, sabers flashing, pistols blazing. They run down here into the valley, get up to this area, and Wells sees that there's a line of Confederates behind the wall. He can see the flag, and then a sheet of flame, perfect sheet of flame, hits them, and the charge just stops dead in its tracks. Horses go down, men go down. There's a spattering of return fire. Farnsworth rides up, orders the men to get out. This is the trap. Get out, get out. And those are his last words. Wells leads his men, some of them actually escape, back down the trail into the Spider Farm area where they're rounded up and captured. Many of them leap over this wall, ride through a couple of Confederate skirmishers and then back to their position, but Farnsworth is left behind. Now, there's two versions of what happened to Elon J. Farnsworth at this point. As Farnsworth is attempting to get his men out of the trap, he is shot and instantly killed right here at this spot. The 1st Vermont Cavalry Monument marks the exact spot where Elon J. Farnsworth fell. There is a version also that Farnsworth dehorsed. His horse was shot out from under him. He was on foot. The Confederates approached him, ordered him to surrender. He turned the pistol on himself and killed himself. That is a very fanciful story and one I don't really believe, to put it mildly. I think really what happened was Farnsworth was killed as he was trying to rally his men and get out of here. Farnsworth was not the type of personality just to kill himself because of dishonor or whatever. Comes back to the basic fact is this is a charge that Farnsworth did not want to make. He didn't think it was going to work. Kilpatrick, and comparing the two, Elon J. Farnsworth is a 6'2", husky guy, ruddy complexion, like your football player type of guy. Strong, tough, follows orders to the letter. Judson Kilpatrick has come the exact opposite. Flamboyant. Kilpatrick is always one to jump at the chance. Kind of like the guy who puts his puts his foot into his mouth every time he opens his mouth. That's Kilpatrick. Kilpatrick, when he received that aid from Pleasanton's staff, who said that Hood is trying to press the Union left, Kilpatrick ordered Farnsworth to make this charge. And Farnsworth said, "General, do you mean that I should send my men down into this trap?" And Kilpatrick replied, "Well, if you're afraid to lead it, I will." Well, that's an insult. and honor these men back then was much more important, I guess, than it is today in some cases. But Farnsworth was highly insulted. This was a slap in the face. Farnsworth actually had his saber half-drawn. He said, "Do you mean that? Do you mean that?" And there was a stone silence. Kilpatrick just, "Forget it. I didn't mean it. Forget it. Forget it." And Farnsworth, there was a dead silence for a minute. And Farnsworth says, "General, if you order me to make this charge, I'll make it. But it'll be your responsibility." Kilpatrick, "It's my responsibility," and then rode off. So Farnsworth really had no choice. He kind of knew it would fail. And after the war, especially the veterans who came back here, the 1st Vermont, always tried to justify what happened here. Captain H.L. Parsons, who was a participant in the charge, he wrote extensively about it. In 1913, he came back to this point and delivered an address to the veterans and the other people who were here. He exonerated Farnsworth of all fault in this charge. And said, no matter what happens, no matter what people think of the 1st Vermont during the entire Civil War, this was our high point, this was our high water mark here at Gettysburg on July 3rd. So that's the story of the 1st Vermont and the story of Elon J. Farnsworth. Now, once again, it's kind of hard to imagine what it was like at the time of the battle, but all of this area, like I said, was completely open. It was the pasture, the woods, the big round top actually began on the other side of the stone fence up here. We're going to go out here to the road and down to Plum Run. We'll go by the William Wells Monument, and along the way I'll point out some breastworks that were built by the Confederates on July 2nd and July 3rd, which you may not know about. Everybody okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Down here about maybe 40 yards.
Down the path?
Yeah. Yeah, story, John, about
that was the first position, and that's supposed to where Farnsworth was killed
up here. I can't find any factual information to justify that. They moved to this point, I think, because there was some sort of land squabble. At the time they put the monument up, they had bought just a small plot, and the people who owned this property were not really hot on having any monuments, period. Evidently, when the first the Sharpshooters monument went up, they were having people that come down all hours of the day to look at this monument, and it kicked them off. And they were threatening people with shotguns and stuff like that, and their property.
So when they moved the monument up here, and the speech was made that exonerated Farnsworth, I mean, if that had already been moved up here at that point.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to use it or refer to it, so I went out of Battles and Leaders.
Oh, I've got the map. I don't know. I'll just babble. Crash was in the madhouse in the library. I had no time to do anything, and I was desperate today. I said, I gotta look at this stuff, and I'll never forget all these. I just passed through it today.
In sickle cell, you said they don't know that for sure. Is that
that's,
true?
That's an 18, I think that's a pre-1853 tree, but it's never been test dated.
I see.
I do think it's old because it's right on the lane.
Oh, is the Gibbon tree in,
Yeah, that's been tested. That is definitely 1863.
And then there's the quote-unquote Pender tree over there with the lightning rod in it.
Yep.
Is it?
Yeah, that was identified by, the War Department. And one of the Heath tree over there, one of Pender's staff officers supposedly came back and pointed this tree out to Batchelder. Before Batchelder found. So he had actually either staked it or marked it.
The one with the lightning rod.
Yeah.
I know Fred Hawthorne is saying that, you know, there's a couple of trees over there, and there's questions about which one of his own theories, but that.
Yeah, regrettably, Batchelder came to this place so many times. They went out and marked stakes. Mm-hmm. You know, they were staked here, staked there. He never put on a map, or if he did, we don't know, it doesn't exist, or it's in private hands. He never put on a map where all these stakes were.
Wow.
So we don't know. And that's the sad part. I mean, he had all this information, and it's lost. And the sad part is, when Batchelder died, his papers got scattered. It isn't until now that we're getting some of them back.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully it'll show up.
And hopefully it'll show up. One day it may show up. You know, it may be stuck in somebody's attic, or maybe stuck in a folder in somebody's, it's an old map. I don't know what it all means.
Park sure doesn't have it somewhere in a box, huh?
No, we've got some early stuff, not that.
I'm mystified as to why when John B. died, as he was commissioner of the GBMA and then as the War Department, why the War Department did not take possession of his records and papers, but they didn't. And as a result, the stuff got scattered. The same happened to literally all the commissioners. Robbins, Nicholson, Richardson, Cope, all their stuff just got scattered. And I really kind of hope, today a general or an officer is asked, can you turn your personal papers over? And they say, sure, no problem.
I've been told it's over. That cap is on. It's called Position Troops. Now, is that Batchelder's book?
It's based on Batchelder's research. It's the War Department stuff. It's the War Department research.
We're standing in front of the monument to General Wells.
Oh, William Wells. Wells is an interesting figure, especially related to Gettysburg. He's one of the only officers here who has a monument like this, a equestrian or a statue, who was not a general here at the time of the battle. Wells was only a major. He was commanding the 3rd Battalion of the 1st Vermont Cavalry. It's from this general area that Wells retreated to. This is not really where they made the initial assault from. This hill behind us, and the name of the hill, I can't remember the exact name of the hill. This was a battery position. Part of the 3rd U.S. Artillery was up on top of this hill. They had 4 guns up there. And once again, you have to use your imagination because this area was open. There were no trees here, not as thick as it is now. The Slider farm is right through those trees there. That's the pasture. Part of this hillside had been cleared up to the summit. So these guns had a perfect line of fire down here into the valley and all the way up to Devil's Den. As a matter of fact, on the morning of July 3rd, there was a probe where some of the 1st West Virginia went down and tore down fences. The battery up here fired on Confederates over in Devil's Den and evidently did a lot of damage to part of the 1st Texas. Be that as it may, that was the only artillery support that Farnsworth had during his charge. Now, Wells led his men back across Plum Run, which we just crossed over on the bridge, and up onto this area, and they retreated back up this hillside to support the battery and also be reorganized. Wells is an interesting character once again in that he was born and raised in Vermont. He enlisted as a private in the 1st Vermont Cavalry in 1861, and within a couple of weeks he had risen to lieutenant and then captain and wound up as a major. The following year, 1864, he was colonel of the 1st Vermont Cavalry. Wound up as colonel when the original colonel was killed in battle at the skirmish at Salem, I think they call it Salem Church, Virginia. It was just before Yellow Tavern. But Wells rose to command of that, and then when the Army of the Shenandoah was formed, Sheridan took the army to the Shenandoah Valley, Wells wound up as a brigade commander under George Armstrong Custer. Wells was a very efficient soldier, a lot of talent, highly regarded. And after the war was over, he retreated back to private life, became a tax collector, sold insurance for a while, and died quietly in Vermont. But Wells was very well remembered by the men of the 1st Vermont, and that's why there's a statue to him here. Like I said, it's unique in that it's one of the only men who has a statue here who was not a general at the time of the Battle of Gettysburg. What is unique about this monument is the plaque here on the front. This depiction is the charge of the 1st Vermont Cavalry. And John just reminded me that there is a key to this relief of identifying a lot of the people on here. But this is kind of the way it looks as they're charging down through the Slider farm and up to the slope of Big Round Top on the afternoon of July 2nd. A lot of folks come down here on this road and they look up and see this guy and they see that. They have no idea who it is. They just keep going. We're going to go up the road here, and we'll take a look down at the Slider Farm, talk a little bit more about that, and then we'll go up and go down the historic Bushman Lane, which is the lane that Farnsworth and his men used actually to begin their charge.
We just pulled off the road, or walked off the road right in front of the Slider Farm, looking up the pasture.
Where the charge shows why Longstreet didn't want to pull puts people out of position in terms of protecting the flying. Some heard that he didn't want somebody to do to him what he did to Pope at Second Manassas.
Kind of that way, yeah.
Martin brings up a good point in that Farnsworth's charge is not the only cavalry action on this part of the field on July 3rd. Merritt and his division is just south of here, about a half a mile, and they all morning long and into the afternoon pressure the Confederate right flank. That's why that the 1st Texas and some of the other units have been sent down here. There's actually two Confederate batteries stationed up on Seminary Ridge facing into the woods in this direction to answer the artillery fire of the 3rd U.S. and because of the growing, throughout the day, the growing concentration of forces up in here. The forces actually, it's just a small part of Kilpatrick's division. It's only just a small part of Farnsworth's brigade, which includes the 1st Vermont, the 1st West Virginia, the 5th New York, and the 18th Pennsylvania. I hope everyone can see this. This is a map from Gettysburg Magazine that illustrates the route of the charge. We're right down here, right along this fence line. The 1st Texas was sent away from the rallying gathering point at Devil's Den, and they formed a skirmish line along this fence. They were skirmishing with troopers who were up here in the woods and up on the top of the knoll in support of the battery. Farnsworth led his charge just from the position just over here to my right. They went across the meadows, over the fences, and then around the buildings up to the base of Big Round Top. These fences are really important. The spider farm is missing about 60% of its fences today. All of them, almost all of them, except for the few stone fences, were just like this. For a horseman, this is an impediment. For an infantryman, it's a bulwark or a breastwork. It's something that can be used for protection, however so slim. But for a cavalryman, it is a literal pain in the neck. You have to get over it or around it, or you have to knock it down. You jump over this on a horse, and horses, during the Civil War, weren't these huge, giant chargers. Your average horse maybe stood about 4.5, 5 feet high. They were actually very small, very compact. They're not like thoroughbreds or Tennessee trotters or horses like that today. The average cavalry horse is actually quite small. And if you look at photographs of people even like George Armstrong Custer, they did not have really large mounts. They did not have very large horses. And for these smaller horses to try to jump this, they would. They'd run right into it. And if they were able to get over it, with a 140-pound cavalryman on the back, who's also carrying about 40, 50 pounds of equipment with a carbine, that cavalryman's going to go right over the head, and you're going to break the horse's leg. So the fences had to be torn down. They were an impediment. Early in the afternoon, part of the 1st Vermont was ordered. Matter of fact, it was Parsons, Captain H.L. Parsons' company. He ordered 8 men to go down here to try to tear down these fences. Well, that was literally suicide. Kilpatrick was up on top of the hill with the 3rd U.S. and watched this group of 4 men ride down in this area, pistols blazing, sabering the Texans along the fence here. And the Texans just proceeded to shoot them to pieces. One man was killed, 2 of them wounded. And they only tore down maybe a small part of the fence. That's the problem. When Farnsworth began his attack, the fence wasn't down, and they actually charged and funneled through this small area where the fences had been broken down. Now, somebody's going to ask me, where was this gap? I don't know. We don't know today. We just don't know. We don't know, but it was somewhere along this line, just to my right. Between here and a small lane, this is the Bushman Farm Lane, it's the original lane with the stone walls, is where Farnsworth charged. So as we walk up the road here, we're literally walking along the line of departure for Farnsworth and his attack in the Slider Farm.
The Vermont Cavalry riding Morgans. I believe I heard that.
What?
Where it was the Vermont Cavalry riding Morgans.
I don't know. You got me. You got me. If they're riding any horses, like any standard Union outfit, it's just whatever the Army supplies. And they're buying from every supplier that they could find.
Yeah, I think they may have been originally outfitted with them, whether they're running left by that point.
We left the Slider pasture, came back up the road, and we're now turning right onto the Bushman Lane.
It collapsed, and somebody tried to steal push the other gun off the block a couple months back.
Oh, really? Just a couple months back?
Mm-hmm.
I do remember seeing two of them. I've been up there lately.
One of the carriages just like fell to pieces. I made a mistake. That was not the 3rd U.S., but it was actually the 4th U.S. Battery. 4th U.S. Artillery, Battery E, Elder's Battery, 4th U.S. is up on the knoll. We're right in the Bushman Farm Lane. This is the historic farm lane. It's very much today like it was in 1863. This is the exact path of it. George Bushman lived in a large house, very large barn right up the road here. He used this lane to log and farm lower pasture and part of the property he had here on the southern part of the field. It was used on the afternoon of July 3rd by the 1st Texas, who had their skirmish line right along this wall. There was at least a half a company or a company here in the lane and then extending up towards Seminary Ridge, which is just to your left. In that direction, the top of the ridge, which is actually Warfield Ridge, is about maybe 300 or 400 yards in that direction. There was 2 Confederate batteries up there. They were firing down into Farnsworth's men as they broke through this area here. The 1st West Virginia Cavalry and part of the 5th New York Cavalry made a demonstration in this area. The 1st West Virginia was a very good cavalry outfit, but they had a tough time here. They got into this area right where we are right now. Just as they got to the fence line where the 1st Texas was, they started to go through a gap there that had been opened by some cavalrymen early that morning. They are caught in a crossfire and wound up suffering, I think they lost like 30 or 40 men within a matter of 5 or 10 minutes. So they fell back. There's no way they could go forward. That's why the 1st Vermont with Farnsworth goes ahead unsupported out here in the field all by themselves. We're going to go up the trail here. Be careful because it is kind of treacherous. It's not really even. It's been used quite a bit. And we'll go up to the George Bushman Building right here at the top of the lane. This is part of the 1st Battalion.
We've come out of the lane into the backyard of the Bushman Farm.
Anybody get up here? Did I lose anybody? In the ruts?
Yeah.
Failed to mention is we have a Dots Position group. Some of you may be involved in the Dots Position groups, and a lot of these groups really have done a heck of a lot of work here in the field. And like I said, without volunteers, we really couldn't survive. But the 1st Vermont area up there is open now because of Pittsburgh Civil War Roundtable, and maybe about 10 or 12 people who show up once or twice a year keep that stuff cut back. It's the same for the lane. The entire lane used to be like this section down here, overgrown and impassable. And now, piece by piece, there's a group from New Oxford Middle School that comes up here once a year and is slowly but surely cutting back a lot of the brush and re-centering the regrading the bed a little bit, adding some fill so you can walk on it. Eventually, the entire lane will be open again.
I think I came through here once with Tom before all of that.
Tom Holbrook?
No, Tom Schaefer.
Tom Schaefer? Oh.
I mean, the fact that I could just play connected dots with the bruises on
the plan, which you know is just was approved and been sent out yesterday, and does address some of the overgrowth that we've talked about. And I've said several times, you have to use your imagination. That this area was open, this area was open. Majority of the 500 acres they're talking about cutting back, we've just walked through and walked around. It's southern part of the Bushman Farm and northern part of the Spider Farm. Most of this area was open until the 1920s, when the War Department, because of the lack of money, lack of funding, and actually lack of care at the time, allowed these areas just to grow up. When the Park Service came along, they adopted this idea. The Park Service really didn't understand the concept of preservation of an actual battlefield and interpretation of it. Well, we're supposed to protect the birds and the trees and everything else as well, so we'll just let the stuff grow up. And it was not actively farmed again for years and years and years. So that's why a lot of this tree growth is actually fairly recent as being maybe 50 to 100 years old at the most. Eventually, if the GMP works, and this area is cut down, it may not be in my lifetime, this area is cut down and open again, the site will be almost exactly the way it was at the time of the battle.
Perhaps we should emphasize that.
The 2 Confederate batteries I was talking about were on this rise right up here. The two are up there now, mark the basic position of it. The fir trees wasn't quite as thick as it is now, so they had a perfect shot at the 1st West Virginia Cavalry and the 1st Vermont. There was a company, I want to say, at the 1st Vermont that got in the lane itself. You can see how narrow it was. At the time, it was lined with rails on top of those stone walls. This small company got trapped in there and was annihilated, literally annihilated, by the artillery and by some Georgians from the 15th Georgia that came running up the road into the Bushman Farm area and just shot them to pieces. The Bushman Farm at the time, the barn's original. This is a Civil War barn. Very much like the Slider barn, it's a double log barn. There's two log bays inside. Now, it's been added onto, so it's much larger than it was at the time. And the lean-to garage here is a 1920s addition they put on. This was lived in initially by one of the War Department officials in the 1920s, and then it's been lived in by superintendents. And today it's lived in by the meanest park ranger we have. In the exact configuration it was at the time of the battle. It was used as a hospital.
John Heiser, tape one, side two.
And there were a number of Confederate dead buried right here on the ground. That's what we'll go with today. Everybody okay?
Yeah.
Anybody feeling faint or exactly like this at the time of the battle?
We're standing right in front of the farmhouse.
Center part with a kitchen addition. On the afternoon of the 2nd, when Hood begins his attack, I think it's in the movie. I haven't seen the movie in a long time. But there was a confrontation between Hood and Longstreet. James Longstreet had ridden down into this part of the field at about 4 o'clock just to watch Hood's men go in. Hood rode up to him and confronted Longstreet. There was this brief conference right out here in this little area that Hood said, I need to move around. Let me go around that hill because I'm receiving so much fire from the left. The fire he's receiving is from a battery in the wheat field, Smith's battery on Devil's Den, and actually the skirmish fire, the 2nd U.S., which is stretched all up through here, is so intense in his line that he wants to just avoid them, sweep around and go all the way around. Longstreet says, no, it's too late. We're already involved in the attack, Sam. You've got to go forward. You have your orders. Attack up the Emmitsburg Road. Those are your orders. What Hood was supposed to do was sweep around to the left and drive directly north. That's the basic idea. Longstreet rides off to try and find McLaws, to see what McLaws is going to do next. He's just walking up the line, and about 5 minutes later, an aide rides up, salutes, and says, General Hood is wounded, seriously wounded, and Longstreet says, hope it's not mortal. I'll attend to him later, sending my compliments. And Hood, Longstreet rides on. And it's later that night that Longstreet shows up at the field hospital where General Hood's being taken care of and wounded. He's been wounded, he's being taken care of by the surgeon. And eventually,
his arm.
Right. That goes to show how much I know about this battlefield. his arm is amputated.
Arm is wounded, is getting hurt.
That's right. It's just he has no use of it. It's the leg that's amputated. Yes. That's. But that takes Hood out of the action. And when Hood goes out, General Evander Law takes command of the attack, of the division. Law has had no instruction of what he is supposed to do as far as the division is concerned. His orders are to stay attached to the left brigade, which is Robertson's Texans. Robertson's men have swept right down here along through this field, around the buildings, and the Texans are now going towards the Devil's Den because that's where they're receiving their fire from. Law only knows to just keep going forward and keep their attachment to the left. Law loses complete control of the entire situation. The attack has already begun. He's heavily engaged at Devil's Den and in the Slaughter Pen area. Little Round Top fighting has not yet begun, but he's also receiving fire and they're starting to fight up in the wheat field area. Anderson's brigade has gone in from the Snyder Farm. That's the Snyder House right up there. The Snyder House is in its 1890s configuration. At the time of the battle, it was a one-and-a-half-story log house. But Anderson's men have swept through. They've gone down the lane over here, which is the historic lane the scouts are on, or whoever they are. They've gone through that lane into the wheat field. If you follow this fence line all the way over, you'll go to the Rose House, which is the stone house. You see the top of it over there. Between here and the Rose House was a massive orchard. Rose owned a lot of property. He owned the wheat field, the woods around it. He owned this property up here, owned a patch of ground here, and he was a very, very prosperous farmer. He had a very rich farm. His orchard was huge, absolutely huge, very extensive. And it's through that orchard that Semmes men charge later that day. And if you've seen the photos of the dead Confederates laying in the field, they say the Rose Farm is taken up in that area. Does anybody have any questions or comments, or have I completely lost you? All this is open, once again. If the plant, we could stand right here, and the Slider Farm is only about maybe 300 yards or so through the woods. You can see it, it's wide open. The only thing between the Bushman house and the Slider Farm was a small orchard on the other side of the barn, which I think that's where Hood was wounded. Yes. Yeah, the trees weren't very large. It's 5:15. We're going to head back down to the farm. Slider Farm's right down the trail over here. Thanks for coming out this afternoon, not just to work, but to listen to me babble. I really appreciate it. And if you have any questions or any comments you want to make on the way back, feel free to do so. Thanks again for coming out.